This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 36 Senate seats will be decided this election day. We turn now not to a report on attack ads or campaign spending, but some other aspects of conduct expected from U.S. senators, namely what kind of hold music is permissible and who can get haircuts at the Senate barbershop. These are some of the rules covered in the Senate Handbook, a 380-page document of policies and regulations that was only recently made public by USA Today. Along with arcane-sounding rules governing office equipment and decor are restrictions on gifts, flights, and other uses of taxpayer money. Paul Singer is politics editor at USA Today. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Virginia. I appreciate the invitation.
So why did USA Today go after acquiring the Senate handbook? Curiosity, or were you looking for something more specific?
We did a story a few weeks ago about members of Congress who were using taxpayer funds to travel on charter flights. And our question at that time was, is this allowable? And the answer we got from people was, well, that's governed by the Senate handbook. The rules are in the Senate handbook. And we said, okay, we'd like to see the Senate handbook so that we can compare what we know to what the rules actually spell out and to see if anybody's breaking the rules. At which point we were told, you can't have the Senate handbook. It's not public.
Well, first, what are the rules on charter flights for senators?
Well, they're detailed and specific, but the long and the short of it is you can use a charter flight when basically you can't get from here to there at any kind of other timely and commercially accessible transit. You know, obviously, senators have very busy schedules. The rules make allowance for that, and they say if necessary, because commercial transport is not available or not available within your schedule, then you can go charter, but then there's a whole series of, you know, you can't use the most expensive charter, you can only use certain types of planes, and the biggest one, you can't use it for campaign purposes. It's only for official purposes, only for official Senate business.
So I'm going to go back to the fact that this has been kept out of the public eye. Not even a copy at the Library of Congress you found at USA Today.
Right.
So how were you able to get a copy?
First of all, I feel stupid. This whole thing makes me feel dumb.
Why is that?
I've been covering congressional ethics for years, and it never occurred to me to ask for this book. I don't know.
Did you even know it existed?
I'm not sure. I mean, people had at various times sent me various bits and pieces of the rules that would govern stories I was working on at the time. But it never dawned on me to go look for the thing. And the Senate has, the Senate Ethics Committee has some stuff, has some manuals and guides on its website. The Senate Rules Committee has some stuff on its website. The House Committee has a House handbook. So it just never dawned on me to ask anybody for this thing. And then finally, you know, when we're getting around to this, I thought, this is ridiculous. Nobody will give me the book. So I just, you know, found a source who was, I don't think the source knew it was secret either, and they were able to provide us a copy.
What are some of the stranger, and I have to say, almost Byzantine-sounding stipulations?
Yeah, it very well could have been written out of, you know, the Supreme Soviet Committee of 1935. You know, I mean, it's the Botanic Garden will make available no more than three plants for each senator's office, three plants at a time, that is, and to be maintained by the Botanic Gardens. My favorite is the sheets of paper. Each member, each senator is provided blank office paper based on a calculation, based on the population of their state, 1 1/3 sheets of paper for each adult constituent in the state. I mean, really, like, it is totally some kind of Byzantine Soviet era manual for running an organization.
There are rules about what kind of curtains you can choose. If you choose to fly a flag outside of your office, it must come in at night. There's no music allowed before 5 o'clock.
I know, I love that. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff. And of course, we were very pleased to discover that the Senate maintains a piano, which they will loan to senators for events.
Well, thank goodness you know that now. I don't know how you've been covering politics all this time without that.
And keep in mind, that means the taxpayers are paying to maintain a piano, and the taxpayers are paying somewhere for a piano tuner, because that thing gets rolled around the Capitol complex all the time.
So what are the chances that incoming senators read this?
Hopefully slim to none. My assumption is that's why they have chiefs of staff who run their offices. Now, I will say there are sections of it that will be very important. There's a whole section on incoming and outgoing senators. So, you know, if you're an incoming senator, what is your budget? How much are you allowed to use to hire people? That kind of stuff, I suspect they would at least take a glance at. But, you know, Senate offices run like small businesses, and the senator runs like a CEO, operates like a CEO. They probably are not down in these kind of weeds. They've hired chiefs of staff to manage that process for them.
As you read through some of the more, I'm going to say, inane specs in the handbook, like there's one explicitly forbidding senators from using appropriated funds for holiday cards. Mm-hmm. One can't help but wonder, you know, which senator was this rule made for?
Right. It's a really good question. You're exactly right. That is exactly what raises your eyebrows. As you see these things, they say, you know, you can't buy gifts for people with your official office account, to which the reaction ought to be, yeah, duh, of course you can't. But at some point, they decided they had to put this in writing. And it also makes you wonder, Virginia, whether that's why this thing has not been public all this time, that they just didn't want to sort of open the floodgates of questions about exactly why they have these stupid rules.
Well, and their regulations there on typewriters and microfiche, how often do you think this is actually updated?
We're talking about the U.S. Senate. It's entirely possible they still have typewriters and microfiche. Keep in mind that they don't, they're still not required to file their campaign finance reports electronically in the Senate. They can still do them on paper. Because the Senate likes to maintain its prerogatives, one of which is to make this stuff as hard to access as possible. One of the reasons why this rule book has never been public is because the Senate doesn't like making things public, period, end of sentence.
Overall, Paul Singer, does looking at this Senate handbook, does it reveal anything about our country or the way our government functions for you?
What it reveals to me more than anything else is just how shy the Senate is about explaining how it operates to the American people, because in fact, there are extraordinarily detailed, extraordinarily Byzantine rules for almost everything. And the Senate's fear, I believe, is that once we see the rules, we will be able to ask them more questions about whether they're complying with the rules. And that is a question they don't want to answer. What the handbook tells me more than anything else is that they actually do operate with structure. They just prefer we don't know what it is.
The Black Box of the Senate with Paul Singer. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today, which recently acquired and published nearly all of the 380-page Senate handbook. You can find a link to skim through it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next on Word of Mouth, the first in our Good Gig series, conversations with people who have landed their dream job. We're going to hear from a passionate rare bookseller you may know from the Antiques Roadshow. Stick around for that after the break when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Being able to assess what something should cost is a valuable skill. Real estate appraisers evaluate land and property to make sure no one gets burned. Athletic scouts can calculate the worth of amateur athletes, beating others to the punch. And then there is that passionate breed which can appraise rare, collectible items. Ken Gloss is a lion among the latter. He's proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop in Boston, one of the largest and oldest antiquarian bookshops in the country, and an appraiser of rare books and manuscripts for the Antiques Roadshow since 1998. He's with us to kick off our series, Good Gig. Ken, a hearty welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
You brought in so many fantastic-looking rare books. Let's take just a look. What do we begin with?
Well, I would say one of the things that if you want to start off with a newspaper, it's from April 15th, 1865.
Ooh.
Look at the front page, see all the ads, open it up, and by the way, President Lincoln was assassinated. But it's not the headline in the paper. But, you know, this is the way somebody in Providence, Rhode Island might have first seen that President Lincoln was assassinated.
If he got to the second page.
If he got to the second page, past the ads.
It is amazing. And it's so hardy, this paper stock. How much is this worth?
Well, that's worth about $250, $350. The thing is, paper from the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, was actually high-quality paper. Around the 1880s, 90s, it became more wood pulp. And, of course, if you have a modern newspaper from the 1930s, 1940s, they'll crumble in your hand. But if they use this quality paper now, your newspaper would be totally unaffordable. So it's a trade-off.
Ken, just opening it up and fluttering it around, I realize that this is a sound we're hearing less and less, the sound of a newspaper opening up. Probably same for books.
Same for books to a degree. I think people still like books, still read them. What we're losing, and it's not necessarily a terrible thing, is reference in particular. Nobody buys an encyclopedia anymore.
Right.
Very few people buy dictionaries. I think the rare books are going to be the rare books and going to be valuable. I think the bestsellers probably never were and probably never will be. But I'll tell you one great advantage is you can be in Africa in the middle of nowhere. If you can get an internet connection nowadays, you can access all the world's knowledge very cheaply and freely. So for society, that's great. For used bookstores, maybe. Mm. But I'm not too worried. I think I'll be able to do this as long as I want.
Well, I'm looking at some other ones in front of you. It looks like you've got a cookbook of some type.
I have the Woman's Suffrage Cookbook. I mean, you know, when you have charity cookbooks and so on, they've had them for years to come. This is from the late 1880s. People collect things on women's suffrage. This is probably a $500, maybe even $1,000 book. It's a very specialized area. But the people who are interested are really interested.
Okay. So is that book from your personal collection or is it available at your bookstore?
It's available at the bookstore.
Is that a fuzzy line there, Ken?
There's not a big fuzzy line. I'll tell you, most of the things that I get in the store, it's a business. So I buy and sell, and it's always what's coming in next. One time my daughter said to me when she was in high school, she said, "All the great things, don't you wish you still had them?" And I looked at her and said, "Yeah, so I could sell them again." But, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with holding letters of Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, and you're touching them and you know that Thomas Jefferson held this item and touched it. We one time got a letter in, and it was a letter, and Thomas Jefferson was talking about what to do about traitors and terrorists.
Wow.
This was just after the 9/11. He was talking about the War of 1812, mm-hmm. and what he said was they should get the full protection of the law and nothing else. And
wow.
You could have just applied that.
To the Patriot Act that was going on then.
Exactly. But, you know, actually sitting there, touching, holding that item, it still thrills me. But I don't keep large collections myself.
Well, that's a question. I mean, I've heard there are two types of collectors. There are those who advocate for, you know, enjoying the items, holding them in their hands, as you're saying, or those who you do put the white gloves on everything and store them away, unseen, and they're considered financial investments. What is it to you?
Well, a lot of people, it's collecting. For me, like I say, it's my business in doing this, but I get the great thrill of holding it or getting it to the right library,
or
the right
reading.
Person.
Do you read them?
Well, I read some of them. If books and publishers had to depend on everybody reading every book they had before they bought the next one, we'd all go out of business. There's always that one on the shelf or the pile by the bed that you want to read. But I'll tell you, there's a middle ground between what you just said. I have friends, collectors, people who will buy two copies.
Wow.
Of everything. One, the rare copy they put behind the glass. Number two, the one they read. So there's the middle ground, too.
What are you looking for when you're appraising a book, given that rarity is just one factor in the value?
Well, usually what you're looking for is, well, first of all, what's the title? Mm-hmm. Who's the author? What's the book about? But then you start looking, is it an early edition? Is it a first edition? What's the condition of the book? Is it signed by someone significant, the author, the publisher, someone famous who owned it? And all of this you do very, very quickly. And then you come up with a general idea or price, or there's no way any one person can know everything there is to know about books. But the key is that you have to know where to ask or who to ask or where to look things up. So part of it is the quick look is, oh, yeah, I know what this is, or this needs more work. I've got to spend some time on it.
Now, you've been working as an appraiser on Antiques Roadshow for some time now, since 98. One of the reasons I think that that show is so compelling is seeing the genuine reactions that we get to hear from people having their goods appraised. Now, here's an example. A woman who spoke with you, now you told her that two letters sent to her aunt Bernice by Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung were worth somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000. Let's hear.
And they were just, they were up. She was cleaning it out. They were inside a book. They fell out of the book. She came to the show. She, you know, obviously she knew they had some value, but she wasn't quite expecting what she got.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my. That's wonderful. I think I'm going to have to preserve these a little bit better than just leaving them folded in the envelopes.
Isn't that everyone's fantasy, that they have something fantastically valuable? So what does it feel like for you when you tell people their goods are indeed valuable or, in some cases, worthless?
Well, of course, you always like to be able to tell somebody that it's valuable. One of the things that I tell people is sometimes people present a book for me to look at and they go, you know, we really don't think this is valuable. And I have to say to them, you know, I hate to agree with you. But many people, what you don't realize when you do a lot of this appraising, many people are absolutely thrilled mm-hmm. when I tell them a book is not valuable.
Really?
Well,
the pressure's off?
The pressure's off. They don't have to take care of it. Many, many cases, if it's a children book, they want to give it to their grandchildren. If you say it's worth $200 or $300, it doesn't change anybody's life. If you say it's worth $20,000 or $30,000, well, that's a whole different reaction. I had a lady at one of my talks, and she had a whole box of papers, and they were nice. They'd been up in the attic, and we're lifting through them, and then we hit one, and it says, A Declaration of Independence.
What?
It wasn't the first edition. It was about a week later. It was worth $750,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And my guess is she lived in an old house that probably had been in the attic since 1776, but needless to say, she was happy.
Wow. You must have seen a lot of really valuable pieces like that come through your bookstore and through your appraisals and your shows.
It's some of the things that I just feel fortunate. Not everything that I've owned. I got called by a museum just to do an appraisal. And I looked at – I saw on what they wanted me to look at. I said, look, I do a lot of favors for them. The great museum. I'll do it for free, but I don't want to do it from your website, from anything. I want to
you have
hold
to
it, touch it.
It.
Yeah. Anyways, a four-page handwritten letter of Paul Revere's ride by Paul Revere.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm sitting there holding a four-page account of Paul Revere's ride done a week after the ride and him describing in detail what happened. And this is Paul Revere's.
So, Ken, is that the thrill of the chase for you? I mean, I'm sure you have days that are a little more mundane than that.
Yeah. Although, in many cases, we go to somebody's house, we go up to the fifth floor walk-up, they have 2,000 general used books, it's 95 degrees out, you get a great workout. But that's the part of the business that a lot of people don't realize, but that's as important as sometimes the very rare and esoteric and fun things.
Well, I'm going to play another clip. In 2012, sure. You appraised a first edition of Cormac McCarthy's book, The Orchard Keeper, told the owner that at first glance might have been valued at about $3,500, but then you noticed something. Let's hear the clip.
One of the things that you run into nowadays is where the dust jacket is 90% of the value. There are many people who copy a dust jacket. They can do it incredibly well nowadays.
Okay.
So the book, as it is, with a dust jacket that's not right, is worth retail $100 or so.
And it was originally worth $5. It was free to me. So if it's a $100 book, it's a $100 book.
Well, he's pretty good-spirited about it, but you know, this is kind of an odd case. But over the course of your career, especially now that printing and design techniques are so sophisticated, have you seen a lot of these so-called rare books that are fakes?
You don't see many rare books that are fakes because to fake a rare book is a huge job and actually could be more expensive than the rare book would be. Mm. What you do see is fakes of the inscriptions, signatures. One of the things, though, that does happen is the paper dust jacket on a book can be way more valuable. Like that clip, if you have The Great Gatsby, you have a nice first edition without the dust jacket, it's worth a few $1,000s. With the jacket, it might be worth a few $100,000s.
Wow.
You got to watch out for that once in a while, but it's still the signatures, the inscriptions that we watch for more.
You know what collectors want. Have you ever made a terrible bet on and put out a lot of money on something that didn't sell?
Well, what I always tell people, if you're either a collector, in the business, whatever, the biggest mistake you can ever make is not ever making a mistake. Because if you don't make a mistake, it means you're being so conservative and passing up lots and lots of good things. Of course, you can't help but make mistakes. Sometimes I've bought books, paid a good price, and hadn't checked them closely enough and realized that maybe there's a few pages missing, which have brought them down to nothing. And then once in a while, I've missed on a signature, and you have to. You can't do it. But again, the biggest mistake is not taking chances. And a lot of times, those chances you have to do either at an auction or from another person, just have to do it on right then and there,
yeah.
And there's no time to do the research. So you take a chance.
You got to know what you're doing. So what's the oddest way that you ever found, got, or heard of a book being come across? You know, is it Thrift City or something like
well,
that?
Well, no. I've had it's pretty much almost anything you can imagine. But one of the oddest ways is I one time got a call. And this one actually would have played great on radio. I was down in the basement of a farmhouse on a concrete floor. There were old trunks. They had to move the trunks. You open the trunks and you heard them creaking open. And then the newspaper wrapping the books up were from the 1930s.
Wow.
So these books had probably never been touched since the 30s. And you open them up and there were books on Captain Cook's voyages, anatomy books from the 1500s. I mean, tremendously
wow.
valuable books that had just been probably in the space. The reason they wanted to, the reason they had called me in, they'd been sitting there for all these years, is I guess the pipes from the heater ran under this concrete floor and they had to move the trunks to get at the fixing of the floor. That's why they called me in. Needless to say, the books more than paid for the repair.
Well, old books are not always valued just for their contents or their rarity, sometimes as aesthetic objects. I noticed on your website that it's specifically for decorators. So do a lot of people come in and say, I don't necessarily want to read or collect books, but I want books that are going to look good on a shelf?
Well, first of all, when you talk about decorators, a lot of movies come in
right.
and advertising sets. Mm-hmm. We've had a few recently. We one time had, and this was one of the stranger orders, someone ordered 6,000 red books. They had to be some shade of red. Now it's
and did you have them?
Yeah, we got them. But it actually made more sense. It was for Ann Taylor, and they had a red dress. They wanted 100 books in the display. They had 60 stores, 6,000 red books.
Wow.
But, yeah, there are people who just, you know, they want their living room or library to look intelligent. They have no care or clue, whatever. They just want to fill up the shelves. On the other hand, there are beautifully done, beautifully illustrated covers and designs. And graphically, those can be really, really beautiful. And so people are collecting the design of the book as art, and that's a whole different type as opposed to, oh, just fill the shelves up.
Now, Ken Gloss, your family has been doing this for a couple of generations now. Had you not been born into this, what do you think you would be doing, or can you imagine yourself doing anything else?
Well, I have a degree in chemistry from
no
University
kidding.
I was going to get a doctoral in Wisconsin, and in 1973, my father wasn't well. I had worked at the store all through my younger years. Not necessarily by choice, mm-hmm. but it was a family business. And he wasn't feeling that well. I needed a year off. That year now has been about 40 years. and tell you the truth, I don't regret not being in a laboratory somewhere. I mean, this is like a treasure hunt. It's like being Jim Hawkins almost every day, not knowing where you're going to go, who you're going to meet. It's really a lot of it. It's the people and the houses. And, of course, you want to find good books and so on.
Ken Gloss, proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop in Boston, what a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Ken's also an appraiser for the Antiques Roadshow, and there's much more on his bookstore and his many public speaking events at wordofmouthradio.org. Have you got a good gig? Well, we're looking for guests for our series, so if you love your job, we'd like to know about it, especially if it's a job few people do or think of as work. You can go to our Facebook page and tell us about what you do, or send a brief email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put good gig in the subject line. That's wordofmouth@nhpr.org with good gig in the subject line. While books inspire awe in some, for others, it is pure panic. Keith Harris was raised in Guyana, but his mother sent him to the U.S. for ninth grade. When Keith first started high school in Brooklyn, his teachers thought he was stubborn and resistant to class participation. And he was, because he didn't want them to know he could not read and write. Keith recorded this for Radio Rookies when he was 17.
A Broken Heart by Keith Harris. A broken heart is filled of tears and pain. To survive without his love, his life ain't nothing but us. My life. Start over. A broken heart. Oh my God, I don't like listening back to myself. I keep making mistakes. One more time. A Broken Heart by Keith Harris. 2 years ago, I could not read or write. It's easy for me to tell you now, but I spent most of my life hiding the truth.
Hello. Hello.
This is my mom.
Keith, I would like you to make me proud.
When I was growing up in Guyana, I didn't make my mom proud. School was my enemy.
Scared me.
Instead of going to class, I would go play cricket, gamble with my friend, or go swimming. One time, I almost drowned.
A man come home and told us a little boy actually drowned. So I didn't really think it was Keith until when Keith showed up. Keith eyes red, red, red. That was the little boy was in the river.
I was a bad boy.
Oh.
On Sundays, as soon as church was over, I would run straight home just because I didn't want to have to read the Bible out loud in Sunday school. I never told anyone that I couldn't read and write. I wanted it to be a secret, so we all pretended everything was fine. Sometimes, my mom still does.
Well, school in Guyana was brilliant. Very perfect.
Perfect? What was my report card like?
Keith used to get like 75, and I think that was good.
Nah, she's lying. I used to fail. By the time I was 14,
Keith loved to gamble.
I was getting into so much trouble, and my mom sent me to the U.S. for high school.
I had to beat him on his hands.
But I was already really good at hiding my problems.
Yo, what up?
My number one rule, never ever read out loud.
What is King Alfonso writing about?
I don't know.
When it was close to my turn, I would always ask to go to the bathroom. When I tried to read, the page looked like a forest with no single tree. Everything was just a blur. And my handwriting, oh my God, it was scrappy and nappy like barbed wire. I hated it.
Write one more paragraph.
All I wanted to do and all I did was play basketball. And believe it or not, it was basketball that got me to start paying attention in school.
When Keith first came in, I remember seeing him in the gym. I saw a tall, lanky kid.
Coach Jones wanted me to play on the basketball team, but he told me I need a 75 average. Guess what? He was lying.
You didn't need a 75 average. You just needed to pass a certain amount of classes.
He wanted me to be a good student.
I wanted to try to push you.
I really, really wanted to make the team. I wanted to be the next Dwayne Wade from the Miami Heat, like everyone said I could be. But to get 75 average, I needed help. I could not keep my secret anymore.
Hi, Miss Gatman.
Miss Gatman was the first person I told I couldn't read.
I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't want you to be embarrassed. So I was like, okay, give him a comic book and he can tell the story through the pictures. But that still must have been frustrating for you because you couldn't read the words. You must have just been like, this woman is crazy. What is like, I just told this woman I can't read and she handed me a comic book.
In the 10th grade, Ms. Gutterman got me into a class just for students who can't read and write. Ms. Bauer changed my life.
Do you remember one of the first books you read in independent reading with me?
Yeah, The First Part Last. Yeah.
The First Part Last.
That's my favorite book. It's the first book I ever finished reading.
I read it like twice in like probably in 2 months.
When she asked me to read out loud, I did it because no one would laugh at me.
You were quiet and you would mumble and I'd always say, sit up and speak clearly. And I'd stand all the way on the opposite side of the room and I'd say, you need to speak up so we can hear you. And now I never have to say that. You always speak up because you want everyone to hear you.
When reading finally started to make sense, I was so proud of myself. I laughed so much, my jaw started to crack. And around that same time, Dwayne Wade and the Miami Heat won the NBA championship.
The Miami Heat, they've done it. They win their first.
Dwayne Wade, he throws it up in the air, Magic Johnson.
Everything was just great. He won and I won.
Congratulations to Dwayne Wade, Finals MVP.
When you started here in 9th grade with Ms. Kelterborn, you had failed both English classes. And now you're scoring 80s in English?
At the end of my junior year, my guidance counselor, Ms. Hughes, told me I'm on track to graduate, as long as I pass the state test.
The fact that you haven't given up, but rather you've used your frustration as power, impresses me like you can't imagine.
Yes, I can't believe it myself. I learned to read so fast. But just because I'm reading right now, does not mean things are easy. There's still a lot more work to do, and I'm doing it all by myself. My mom visits once in a while, but she still lives in Guyana. I wish she was here to help me.
Yo.
Last year, when I took the SAT test, there was no one to make sure I have money or food or even to take me there.
I'm gonna take the SAT test. It means so much to me. Damn, I'm nervous. Can I have a pencil? 2 pencils? Number 2.
I had to sign up, buy pencils, and figure out to get there all on my own.
Miss, can I ask you a question? Have you ever taken the SAT before?
I took it to internet.
It was hard?
If you study, it wouldn't be hard.
All right.
God bless you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for this pencil, man.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you to read a word list to me.
2 years ago, I could never imagine myself wanting to take a test.
Today I'm doing an assessment with Ms. Bauer. She's trying to test out my level of reading, and I just hope it's at least a 10th grade and not like 7th or 6th, because I'm going to be real mad.
Read it, like all the words?
Okay, you're going to read it one word at a time. Start with word list A.
Get, is, and, there, see, not.
I was saying the word so fast.
Hold on.
It was so easy.
Okay, that's good.
But after a while, it got harder.
The little sick girl would stay equally in bed. Wait. The little sick girl would stay quietly in bed at home while her mother was away.
After the test, Ms. Bausak could find out my score if I wanted. But I decided not to. I am not ready yet. If she says I'm still at the 6th or 7th grade reading level, I don't want people to know. I believe in the truth, but sometimes the truth hurts a little too much.
And hearing something like that might make me want to give up, which I'm not going to do.
I don't want my mom to be embarrassed by me. I want her to say to everyone that when I was in Guyana, I could not read or write. But now, I can.
I'm in the kitchen. No food is cooking, though. This is my mom. Can you give me, like, a summary of my report card in Ghana?
You?
This time be true.
You used to fail.
So remember last time when you was lying and you was like, I had 75? Why you say that?
Because I was ashamed of you.
One thing you like about me in America?
You develop very fast and you learn, and I admire you for everything you have done.
For WNYC, I am rookie reporter Keith Harris.
Keith recorded that story for Radio Rookies in 2008 when he was just 17 years old. We do have a little update from the folks over at Radio Rookies. Keith is now studying criminal justice at John Jay College in New York City and plans to become a police officer. When Word of Mouth continues, a conversation with comedian and actor Bob Odenkirk, who played strip mall lawyer Saul Goodman on Breaking Bad and will soon star in its spinoff, Better Call Saul. We'll be doing just that when Word of Mouth continues. Stay with us.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Bob Odenkirk is a busy man. After hitting the big time as strip mall lawyer Saul Goodman on Breaking Bad, he's set to star in a spinoff, Better Call Saul, early next year. He's also been praised for his role as a small-town sheriff in the TV show Fargo and his restrained acting in the Oscar-nominated film Nebraska. Long before becoming a Hollywood face, however, he'd reached near cult status for his contributions to the world of sketch comedy. First as a writer for Saturday Night Live, then The Ben Stiller Show, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and most devotedly as co-creator of Mr. Show with David Cross, in which he wrote and played characters ranging from a hyper-conservative Dixiecrat senator.
New Mexico! When was the last time anybody was in New Mexico? Be serious. Grand Canyon? Just sitting out there collecting dust. The Great Lakes, cluttered with water. I believe it's time to sell it. We're taking bids now. Best offer gets it.
To a morally bankrupt British TV producer.
Ronnie, I'm going to put it to you bluntly. How long have you been not drinking?
Terry, I drink all the time. You know me, come on.
No, you come on, Ronnie. What's in this?
Terry, come on, that's for cocaine.
Bull, Ronnie, it's fucking baking soda.
A similar array of voices is front and center in Odenkirk's debut collection of writings, A Load of Hooey, in which he channels out-of-touch politicians, perpetually dissatisfied critics, an ill-prepared Martin Luther King Jr., a beleaguered Paul McCartney, and who could forget Hitler or God? There is plenty of politics and criticism masked in biting satire. When we reached him in L.A., we found Bob Odenkirk's mind to be just as freewheeling as his sketch comedy. And I asked him if comedy was his way of bringing the issues to light.
Absolutely. It is also a playground to kick things around in. So I don't really feel like I condemn all religion or all politicians. In fact, I don't like people who do that. But comedy and these pieces are a place to ridicule some of the sillier aspects, including the hot button issues.
I'm thinking of the essay, Putting It Out There, you know, which begins, if I were running for president, and then you announce you're being transparent, like the character says, I cheated on my wife, Betty, many, many different ways with many, many different people. Do you wish politicians would do that, or are you making fun of the sort of public fascination with private life?
The public fascination with private life. I think we just go too far in digging into people's peccadilloes and caring about them or pretending to care about them. You know, I was not a fan of George Bush, but I don't care if he did cocaine when he was in college. He could have done it 10 times. I don't care. I just want to know what he stands for. You know, is he upright most days? And, you know, how is he going to lead us? And I don't care if Obama smoked pot. He clearly did. And let's move on. We got work to do.
Well, the politician is one voice. You're a politician in another essay. I misspoke. A number of different voices here. And I wonder, you know, similar to the way that you do sketches, is this how your comedic mind works? You come up with characters and sketches and you start to flesh them out?
Yeah. And in fact, I've done a certain amount of stand-up, and it's sort of the same thing. I enjoy getting a hold of a voice or a point of view, having fun with it and digging in and going places with it. I find that more rewarding than just making observations. Hmm. I mean, it goes back to my childhood. I'm from a family of seven, and our dinner table was a show every night. And we would get up and we would do the people we met that day. It was all clean comedy. My mother is very Catholic. You know, it's just getting a hold of a point of view and seeing how far it can go. I think it is a commentary, though. I mean, when you go look at your point of view, now let's take it further to a comic extent. And if it's ridiculous, then maybe it's ridiculous just on the face of it all across the board.
Yeah, I'm also one of many children, and it was something I wanted to ask you about, because it's funny, dinner table does become the stage, doesn't it? You've got to work out your characters, you've got to work out your shtick if you want to be heard in this crowd.
Yeah, I mean, we would literally get up from the meal.
Oh.
And then acting it out.
You did stand-up at dinner?
Well, I don't know, if it was stand-up, it was characters, and it was more sketch comedy, so I guess it paid off.
And that sketch comedy came across so beautifully in Mr. Show and other things that you've worked on, Saturday Night Live, we mentioned, and Ben Stiller's show. But Mr. Show is kind of a cult classic now and widely considered to be a kind of a watershed moment for alternative comedy. But it was not so popular at the time. What do you think changed, Bob Odenkirk? You know, why did it later catch on?
Well, I don't know the answer. My guess is the internet and YouTube and that kind of sharing of short comedy bits has helped us a lot. But the wave of sketch comedy that comes out of the UCB Theater, Second City in Chicago, Improv Olympic in Chicago, and in Los Angeles, and all the classes and all the improv groups and sketch groups, and now all the sketch shows on TV, I don't know where that came from. I do think it's going to be short-lived. I don't think sketch comedy will ever go away, and I hope it doesn't because I love it. But I do think we're living in a little bubble of cultural excitement over sketch comedy, and then everyone will move on to something else. I remember the stand-up boom in the 80s. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that was crazy. We went from having like two clubs in Chicago to having like eight. And then there was, literally comedy, stand-up comedy night, literally every night of the week. Monday night, you could go to a bar and they'd have stand-up night. And if you could write some jokes, you could get paid $20.
But I wonder for you, Bob, you know, you've been kind of a guru to the web generation. You've inspired people. Derek Waters of Drunk History acknowledges you. Adult Swim's Tim and Eric.
Yeah.
How do you feel about being a sort of an elder on the comedy scene?
Well, you know, listen, I understand what you're saying, and it's very nice. I mean, I had mentors like Del Close, one of the great teachers of improvisation, who inspired me to do this. So I know what that's like. I mean, I got to say, I don't do it consciously. I don't think, how can I be a teacher today? Or how can I go be important to younger performers? I do my own thing. I write stuff. Right now I'm acting in Better Call Saul, which is a spinoff of Breaking Bad. But I can't help myself. When I see a young act like Tim and Eric sent me their DVDs years ago, and I put it in and I watch it and I think, oh my God, these guys have a voice. I've never seen it before. It's exciting. It's funny. It's weird. It deserves a stage. I can't help but want to call them, talk to them. How are you doing it? Here's what I think you could do. I made a huge mistake when I was young.
What's that?
I've been at Saturday Night Live for 2 years, and I took all the money I had, and I made a one-hour special for TV. I don't know for who, and had costumes and locations, and we shot it, and we edited it, and we did the sound mix. It cost a lot of money. It did get me some attention. The HBO executives watched it. They called me in for a meeting, and they said, this is really cool. We can't put it on. No one knows who you are. We can't just put that on. No one will let us. But you know, you're good, and we think you're neat. And later I worked on the Ben Stiller Show, which they produced, and then obviously Mr. Show, and I actually did four or five pilots with that team over at HBO over the years. So I made friends. But here's the thing. I didn't need to make a one-hour special. I could have achieved everything I achieved by shooting a 15-minute sampler. And that's where I think somebody with more experience can give you a shortcut, can see what you're doing and say, here's a couple ideas that can save you 2 years.
Well, let me ask you about that, because now, you know, you've been on Breaking Bad. Now you're developing Better Call Saul with Breaking Bad's showrunner, Vince Gilligan. And this is after years of being, you know, not the face. You were behind the scenes in the writer's room, feeding and partnering with and feeding the careers of a stunning list of comedic talent. So how does that transition to being the face, a more recognizable, a more visible presence feel to you?
I try not to think about it.
You've got a good face.
I have a doughy face.
Do you?
I do.
Well, you look very authorial in the one where you're wearing glasses, you have a cat on your lap, smoking a
you're
pipe,
awesome.
Holding a glass of wine.
You're awesome. That I did that for you. I did that for you.
I felt it.
And I wanted to do multiple author photos and multiple about the author things. You know, the book is an indulgence. In the end notes, I thank the Lily Guild. And I don't know if you know what gilding the lily means.
I do.
Yeah, because I know that my comedy writer friends, some of them are going to go, great job. I've already had a few. And some of them, are reading it going, oh, he just went on and on with his little ideas. They're going to see that I just dug in and indulged myself. And, you know, hey, that's what the book is, you know.
Bob Odenkirk, last year you co-authored another book, Hollywood Said No, with David Cross. It's kind of a collection of rejected scripts that you'd submitted.
Mm-hmm.
Are things going to be different now that Hollywood seems to be saying a big fat yes?
Yeah, I don't know if it is saying a big fat yes. I mean, look, Vince Gilligan is saying a big fat yes.
Fargo is saying a yes. Alexander Payne is saying a yes. You seem to be quite in demand.
I'm very thankful, and I can't believe it, and I just try to keep my mouth shut and not jinx this little run of luck I have here. I really got to tell you, this show, Better Call Saul, is kind of mind-blowing.
Well, it's supposed to be a prequel. Are we going to see Saul before he has his comb-over, for example, and before he has the inflatable Statue of Liberty in his office?
Yes, you are.
Oh.
I can't tell you much, but I can tell you that.
Okay.
And I can tell you that Vince Gilligan is, and Peter Gould, they're the two creators of the show, are just setting new standards for me for the writing I'm reading and the work I get to do. And I can't wait to see it and share it with people. And it's just been a crazy challenge and a joy to do it. And I don't know. I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't know what to say to good fortune. I'm much better at talking about failure than I am with talking about good fortune. I don't know what to do with that.
Bob Odenkirk, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Bob Odenkirk, a writer, comedian, actor, sketch performer, director, and now author of A Load of Hooey. With as much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
You drink one, drink two, drink three Long Island iced teas. But your buddy's worse off when he throws you his car keys. Blue lights are blinking, 4 o'clock in the morning. State Trooper makes you wish that you'd never been born.
Better call Saul, better call Saul.
You want to tell the world.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we spoke with the passionate bookseller and Antiques Roadshow regular Ken Gloss for our new series, Good Gig. Conversations with people who've landed their dream job. And we're looking for more guests for our Good Gig series. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have a great gig? Do you go to work each day feeling inspired? If so, we'd love to know about it, especially if it's a job few people do or think of as work. You can go to our Facebook page and tell us about what you do, or send a brief email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put Good Gig in the subject line. That's wordofmouth@nhpr.org with Good Gig in the subject line. We find some of the most fascinating stories through word of mouth. Let's hear yours. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more word of mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
get to the bank, but the cops say, whoa, who are you gonna die when they lock you down? Oh, Saul, Saul, you better call Saul. He'll fight for your rights when your back's to the wall. Stick it to the man, justice for all. You heard me, you better call Saul.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Your customers are gone and your store is on the rocks.